Hi, I'm Joni Deutsch, host of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's A Change of Tune. Since the show began almost 2 years ago, A Change of Tune has highlighted some of the best up-and-coming artists out of these West Virginia hills, with podcasty chats that range from Sean Richardson to Good Wolf, Heavyset Pawpaws to Bishops, and beyond. But those interviews have been a bit infrequent, and since West Virginia Day is coming up, not to mention A Change of Tune's second birthday, we thought we'd do something special. 30 days, 30 brand new West Virginia music interviews that range from Morgantown alt-rockers to Parkersburg singer-songwriters to venues and management and artists, all of which contribute to this state's wild and wonderful music scene. And today, we are chatting with Parkersburg's own Todd Burge, who's often named one of West Virginia's premier singer-songwriters. From choir boy to punk rocker to folky acoustic musician, Todd Burge has played it all and seen it all. He's even co-hosted Mountain Stage with Larry Gross. But we'll get to that in a second. Here is Todd Burge.
It could be lost forever now, unread, unshown, and thrown away.
So do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself and what you do for a living?
Sure. I'm Todd Burge, and I consider myself a touring singer-songwriter, West Virginia touring singer-songwriter.
Now, you're currently based in Parkersburg, West Virginia, but is that where you're originally from?
Well, very close. I grew up in Vienna and went to school at Parkersburg High School, ended up in Morgantown after that, WVU, went there for 4 years, and pretty soon after that, I realized I wanted to, I wanted to be a songwriter pretty immediately because the scene there just really, really inspired me and clicked with me. And I wasn't a musician. I sang in choirs in school and all that, but I didn't really play an instrument until I got to WVU. I played piano, but I didn't like it. But I didn't play guitar. But in very short order, I saw a couple bands and jumped into the music scene. And really at WVU, I took classes that I thought would help me with my songwriting. There wasn't like a course or anything. And long story short, I moved to San Francisco, had a label deal, and moved to San Francisco. Label went under, came back to West Virginia, started a rock band and toured up and down the East Coast and somewhat around the country for a few years. Ended up kind of meandering into the acoustic version of what people hear now, but that's the condensed version of what I do.
So you didn't really consider yourself a musician until, what, around college, would you say?
I've been very musical all my life. My mother kind of would fill in as a choir person at the church we went to, the Methodist Church, in a really tiny town called Boaz. It's outside of fairly close by here, and so I was around music around that. I was in choirs and I loved it. I was in kind of for lack of a better word, kind of an elite choir. There was a huge
Ooh.
Choir at PHS, but there was like a chamber choir. It was kind of like, and so it was like it got down to the nitty-gritty and did the serious stuff, and we competed and all that, and called it a chamber choir at PHS. And so I was always very musical. I took piano lessons because I was interested, and then I immediately was too lazy to really learn music the way the piano teacher structured it. And really, I consider, attention deficit led me to songwriting because I'd make up stuff at the recitals and frustrate my instructor. I was making up and kind of improvising stuff, but it was really just laziness. I didn't have, I learned how to be disciplined later. But yeah, it was really the punk rock scene of Morgantown in the 80s. It really struck me. I can pinpoint when the second that I decided that I had to be a songwriter and had to get into the music scene. I was turning the corner of Kingwood and Wilson, and I heard a band called Gene Pool on U92 there in Morgantown and on the radio, and it was a song that I'd heard the night before called Pilots Are Melting. And it was my first venture into the Underground Railroad there, what's now 123 Pleasant Street. And I heard that song on the radio, and it was just like as silly as it sounds, it was like a bolt of lightning. And I thought, I've got to do that. Here's a local band on the radio. Are you kidding me? And that didn't happen in Parkersburg, you know. And it was unheard of. It just blew me away. And I don't know, six or seven weeks later, I learned three chords, got together with some buddies, and we were playing in a garage and writing songs and stuff, you know. So
you turned from being a choir boy into a punk rock superstar.
Let's not say superstar.
Okay,
but
just a star. It's okay. We'll
in
just
my mind. I tell you what, there was an attitude there. There was this do-it-yourself attitude, and we watched bands like local bands like Gene Pool, The Inbred, who toured internationally, touring a hardcore band called The Inbred. And just being around that and watching these guys and knowing that they went out and toured. And you know, bands like the Dead Kennedys would come through town, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Cowboy Junkies, Bo Diddley, and people like that would come through too. So you saw all the stuff coming through that venue. And, you know, live music is crucial. But, you know, we went from a choir boy to literally weeks later, playing at some, you know, a club here in Parkersburg. There was one original band that I knew of that asked us to open, and we did six songs. The band was called The Larrys, and we did six songs, and then we played three of them again, you know. we caught something. We caught this illness. And we're trying to find the remedy, and we didn't quite know what it was, you know. So it was wild. Thinking back on that, it was wild how it happened so very quickly, you know.
Yeah. But which bands were you a part of when you were in that scene?
Well, we started out a band called the Larrys, and it was really, you know, it was back in the days of cassettes. We made a cassette, we made a four, and then we made a four-song EP. Actually, it was a 33 and a third, and a 45 inch. You know, it looked like a single, but it had four songs on it. And we threw that around to radio stations that would play it that we knew of, but mainly United 2. And we immediately started getting people at the shows, and we thought, oh, this is how it works, you know. But that was the Larrys. You know, it seems like we went on forever because we wrote so many songs. Then after that, I started this other band called Bunge and the Beats. Bunge, B-U-N-J, was like my nickname. That's a story not really worth telling.
Yeah, it is.
But Bunge and the Beats was the name of it. And funny, it sounds like a really silly name, but the Larrys, we wrote all these silly songs, and I was kind of tired of it. And I was bringing in more serious material. And I don't think they were really into it, you know. So I started a different band, and then actually the Larrys immediately got signed to this label once I left. I had to do business with the record label because some of the songs they were doing were mine, and then they got turned on by my new band. So we were both signed. I went out to San Francisco with this band called Bunge and the Beats and that's really where I learned the music business because. Most of it was do it yourself, but the label paid for the recordings and all that. And learned how to book shows, and I started booking shows for other bands while I was out there, and I was struggling to find a touring band because the people back home didn't want to tour, the people that made the record with me. So yeah, Bunge and the Beats is really where I cut my teeth in a lot of these, you know, how to book shows and sell your band and sell yourself and all that. And I don't that's a long story short. I just now, this is mind blowing to me. I just now, just literally in the last month, that record never saw the light of day, and that's my label story. Everybody's been in it long enough. It's been signed to a label, has their little, you know, their bad label, bad record business story, you know, and that's kind of mine. I I had a falling out. I couldn't get tour support, and kind of the label kind of went under, and I could never get those tapes for that record, which I really liked. And just literally, this is 30 years ago, this year, literally a month ago, I got those tapes back, and I had it digitized, and I have this record that's never been released, which was my first full length record with this band, Bunge and the Beats. And I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but I still like it. And but came back to West Virginia, started a band called 63 Eyes, which became what people knew me for, and still kind of a lot of people know me for this band that was very active on the college scene in the 90s. You know, when Nirvana exploded and all that, or you know, alternative rock scene started exploding. We were touring, you know, CBGBs and the 930 Club and all those places was the scene that we were in, and putting out vinyl and then CDs, and we were very active for a good many years, and that was the band that most people would know me for, with a band called 63 Eyes.
So when did you transition from being a choir boy to punk rocker, and then you are now a singer-songwriter that's not, you know, I mean, you're kind of punk, but I'm sure you were more punk in the 90s. How did you make that transition from that type of rocker to where and what you do today?
Well, you know, it's funny because it didn't just, like, happen, you know. It was, and I always wrote songs on an acoustic guitar, always. And I would take those songs into whoever I was around. The music became something different depending on what room I was in, you know, and those people that were with me. A lot of people say, you know, Dylan inspired me, or Black Francis, it was my biggest inspiration, or Jello Biafra, whatever. And these famous people. Or for me, I think more realistically, it's, you know, it's the people you're sitting in the room with, you know, whether it's Mark Poole of the Phantom Six, who I was with in 63 Eyes, you know, Jimmy Clinton, and or whether it's Tim O'Brien or William Matheny, you know, the songs become what they are, you know, depending on who you're surrounded by. And I was always really writing what I considered, you know, acoustic based kind of folky sounding stuff, and then I would, you know, put it in whatever weird blender, and 63 Eyes, it happened to be really, it was really melodic, and I still considered it like folk stuff, but nobody would say that about that music, you know. But I had to sing over top of, you know, Chainsaw, and some bone crunching rhythm section or whatever it might be. So it really, but when I got more serious about it, the way I survived in this whole thing through all these years, and I'd highly recommend it to anybody, you know, with 63 Eyes, we didn't. When I came back to West Virginia, and got with these guys and started this band 63 Eyes, there was no way I wanted to do a regular job. Even though I had 4 years at WVU, I took psychology and English, and I wasn't going to go into psychology and then have this as my background thing, my back burner thing, and see, you know, the music thing had to be number one for me. So we realized that there was a big demand for cover bands, and, which everywhere. And how could we become a cover band, an offshoot band? How could we create a different band with the same members so we didn't have to depend on other people? We were just a three-piece. And you know, make that our day job, so to speak. Make that our way to pay the bills while we were home. Because you couldn't play original music in this area, you know, you couldn't just go into bars and play original music. Nobody was doing it in the Parkersburg area at that point. We'd go to the college scenes, we'd go to the 930 Club, we'd go on a tour for 3 weeks, we'd come home, and we'd just have to work on the next 63 Eyes tour. Well, so we started going to the animal lodges, you know, the Moose Club, Eagles, and all that stuff, and seeing what was being done there. And they were all playing, you know, Bob Seger and stuff that kind of wore us out, you know. And we thought, well, geez, nobody's doing Dwight Yoakam and Hank, and you know, as in the original Hank and that kind of stuff, you know. And so we started this kind of rockabilly, traditional George Jones and cover band, and we called it Triple Shot. Same three guys, totally different band, genre-wise, and realized that those places didn't want to hear that stuff, you know. but we forced our way through and finally started getting gigs, and we played every honky-tonk that was imaginable as Triple Shot. And then we'd sneak in, like, Replacements covers.
And, did anyone notice?
No. Like, we would do the regular, and it sounded like a country song. Or we wouldn't do Replacements, like, you know, we wouldn't do Red Light Run It, you know,
yeah.
Scream our heads off. But we were doing Replacements stuff, maybe a couple songs. We'd do some Neil Young. We would throw in some originals. It was like such a music education to learn those covers in that genre, and it's where I learned how to play bass because I was a bass player in that band. It was a valuable education to come up with, like, you know, you had to have 50 songs. We would play, like, the Pub 47 in Parkersburg. We would start on Wednesday, and we'd play till Sunday, five sets a night.
Wow.
And it was like, you know, it was a physical workout, and it was really, you were getting these songs by these like Hank Williams and George Jones and this stuff. You were getting these classic songs embedded into your, you know, your nervous system. I mean, it was like, it was valuable, and then we do the 63i stuff. So we worked every day. We had a practice space here. It was actually a chicken coop that we renovated.
Aww.
And yeah, this woman named Nell Eckert, she was in her 80s. My mom somehow, you know, my mom worked with her daughter and had this chicken coop. It was just like, you know, wind would blow through this place. But she was like really into the fact that somebody'd be on her property and all that. We kind of insulated and put heat in it. We'd go at, you know, we'd meet at 10 o'clock in the morning, and we would work and, you know, and take a lunch break and work into the evening on music and do it every day. And then we'd do country one day, 63i's the next, original stuff, back and forth. And we'd take, you know, we'd book shows. Like, we treated it like a serious, you know, like we were opening up a store and had to go there every day. And, we did it for years. Now, eventually, the band kind of fizzled in one way or the other. It became a thing that we went off. We did different things. I found out that I could play a solo show to, you know, 63i's would go play it for a few hundred people in Morgantown and different places like that. And when it's all said and done, three bands on the bill, four bands sometimes, all that, you know, and split up the money, I started playing some acoustic shows just for fun. Had new material or whatever, I'd be playing like Maxwell's in Morgantown. I'd play this small place and there'd be like 50 people there, and I'd play like two sets and realize, geez, I'm making more money doing this. And so that's really where the acoustic solo stuff started, whereas it was like, it was an ego trip for me to pull off a show by myself too. I have to admit, you know, I need a lot of attention.
What? Well, I mean, that's music, though, right? I mean, you have to be there, the center of attention for 100, 200, 800 eyes. Like, you need to have that ego.
I'm willing to admit that I'm here for the attention, folks, you know? I'll admit it, and I've admitted it for years, and that's really, you know, I'm feeding something. I think, you know, Dad didn't hug me enough when I was a baby, you know. So I need a lot of attention. So there was a thrill, and there still is, you know, there still is a thrill to pulling off a solo show. And I mean, we could talk about that for or I could wear you out on the...
You've already worn me out with your story, Todd. Like, just, I can't... Well, no, it's just you've done so much, and you're still doing so much, and you will continue doing so much. And I just, I feel like if I were you in your shoes, there probably would have been a lot of times that I would have just, I give up. You know, people aren't appreciating my sound, or I'm doing so much work with little outcome. But you just soldiered through it.
Well, but it's like that in anything. You know, I watch my wife and what she does for a living, and you have to struggle through. And a lot of times, you know, what I chose to do was to answer to myself, and you have to, people think I sit here and I write songs all day. You know, that's what people, oh, God, that'd be great. That'd be great to be you and sit around and play music all day. But it's very small. I have to carve out time to do that, to write, and it's a must because it's the product, you know. But it's also a must because, you know, it doesn't survive without that. It's just like anything that anybody does, really. I mean, you have to be tenacious. You have to stick with it. If you're self-employed, and anybody self-employed would know what I'm up against here. My challenge to myself is to always be doing something new and to not repeat myself. You know, and that's a blast, and that's a challenge, and to realize that eventually something interesting is going to come along that I like, and I'll be able to present it, and I try not to get wrapped up in the dry spots creatively. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I kind of try to stay calm in that regard and realize, and every once in a while, you know, you get handed something from wherever that comes from, and it always comes, and I think, oh, this is. I'm not repeating myself here, and I enjoy this, and I think I can present this to people, and that's what it's all about. But the frustrating part is that people don't understand what I'm doing, and then the beautiful part is also that as well. Do you understand what I'm saying?
It's, oh, yeah.
Like, I think that I present a song on Mountain Stage, and I look at this Mountain Stage recording that's out, and that I just released, and I have people approach me and ask me questions, and I realize, oh, they don't get at all what that song's about, you know, or they'll be laughing about a song and they'll think something's funny, and they think, you're funny, you know, that's really funny, and I'm like, oh, that's not a funny song, that's tragic. That's a tragic song, but I don't argue with them. I used to argue with people and try to explain myself, but then I realized
there's no point.
Well, no. Once it leaves me, it's not mine. It's theirs.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. Those interpretations are really a beautiful thing. But I'm continuing to try to. I'm always trying to move towards a point where my feeling and what was in my gut when it first came out of me is what people feel, and that's the journey. Whether it ever gets realized or not, who gives a shit?
Especially if they're buying the record or if they're paying for the songs, right?
Yeah, because the truth is, what I'm doing here, as hard as it is, it's a beautiful thing. And I'm doing what I want, and I've got a place to live. I'm supporting a family along with what my wife, you know, is. My wife loves what she does, and who could ask for more than what's going on here? I'm success has been reached. You know, it's like I'm good with that.
Oh. I'm taking pictures of you behind your back. I once was told that doing that would make things last longer. I long for this to last longer.
You have a new solo release out. It's Todd Burge Live on Mountain Stage, and it's a compilation of some of your live performances on NPR's Mountain Stage with Larry Gross, which is a program that I work on. And the performances of this record start with the year 2006, but that wasn't your first year on the show, now was it?
No. It started in 91, and if people want to know why it starts in 2006, there are two reasons. one reason was like just a technical reason that I believe that around that time the show went digital.
It did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So it was much easier to get those recordings from 2006. Now, there's another thing. In 2006, at that Tamarack show, something clicked in me that nothing before that time for me made sense musically as my performances. Those performances were crucial before that time, between 91 and 2006, but I was not really happy with anything that happened on Mountain Stage. I was a wreck. You know, I was like, I was a mess. I mean, just a bundle of nuts. And so I never really relaxed and performed on that show. And that was a long freaking stretch. You know what I mean? I was on that show many times, and people have told me, geez, I would have never known. But I can't even exaggerate how flaky I was on that show. I was like glad to get it over with. I'm supposed to be. I'm on freaking Mountain Stage. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just couldn't get beyond the nerves. You know.
You mean nerves of you performing on Mountain Stage, or was it just external nerves from life?
And it was just in general. I was just as a human. I was a spaz. I can say it now. It wasn't like I was just. I was not in the moment. I was rarely in the moment. I was always just. Thinking beyond the moment that I was living in. And so musical performances, it was almost like I just didn't really get comfortable on stage as a solo performer until the year 2006. Let's just simplify it and say that. And I remember that show being, I was so prepared. And I think it just, I love Louis C.K. a lot.
he's a good comedian, yeah.
Yeah, along with millions of others, and I study and listen to comedians not because I want to be a comedian, but just I'm fascinated with this, with a person getting up there and a mic and just what's in their head, and performing and entertaining. You know, it's similar to being a solo acoustic songwriter, singer songwriter person in that regard. But Louis C.K. said, you know, has the whole, you know, it takes you know, whatever it is, 10 years to get good, and then maybe another 10 to get great, you know, to be great at what you do. I'm paraphrasing, but it really took me that many years to hone that skill of being a solo acoustic person. And it was around that year that where I got to the point where I felt I had a show, and I had an act, and I had a comfort level where I was real on stage. And I was just faking it up to that point, and I was a nervous wreck. And but I couldn't. I had to do it, and you know, and but you know, we could talk forever about Mountain Stage and how it's boosted my career. It's you know, that's another thing I can't exaggerate what it's meant to what I do.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. So your first show, 1991. What were your thoughts on Mountain Stage around that time when you first appeared on the show?
It was like being on Saturday Night Live. I mean, it was huge. And it still is in my mind. I mean, I haven't, it's not like I've gotten used to being on Mountain Stage and thought, oh, it's another Mountain Stage, you know, even though I've done a few of them, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I think I tried to get on for at least a year and a half, 2 years. And as people do.
And longer, and, yeah.
Well, it's funny. The story goes that I opened up for Tom Wopat in Parkersburg here at the Smoot Theater. And Tom Wopat's from the Dukes of Hazzard, you know,
mm-hmm.
one of those. And he did music and all that. But and I asked Denny Bonet from Mountain Stage Band, the Mountain Stage Band, to play fiddle with me. I didn't know her at all. And I just called her and asked her if she would do it, thinking she would say no. Because, you know, in the music business, most people say no to, you know, most of the time. I'd say 90% of the time, the things you ask or want to do or you're reaching for, no is the answer. And that's just the way it is. And she said yes, and I freaked out. She played with me, and I was kind of like became, you know, so I came in that back door. She listened to my music, and then I started bugging Larry. I sent every newspaper article that was ever written about me. I sent postcards. I would invite them to shows when I come play Charleston, on and on and on. And then I was supposed to be on a show with Joan Baez. Larry told me I was going to be on a show with Joan Baez, and that just blew my mind. You know, God, she used to date Bob Dylan. You know, but anyway, Joan Baez, and I got bumped by Bob Mould from the first Mountain Stage. And then I waited another 6 months before I was on that first one. But then from there on out, you know, I was able to say I was on Mountain Stage, and I got shows from it, and I would, you know, I literally would book shows, you know, this is pre-internet, you know, I would book shows, I'd call people, and I could, this happened. It wasn't like it was this flood, you know, the floodgates opened or anything. But I literally would get shows on the road by saying I'd been on Mountain Stage without sending stuff, you know. Maybe an opening spot or something like that. And it's through the years, it's worked for me in that way. It gives you cred.
It gives you street cred by being on Mountain Stage. And I mean, Larry said some really nice things about you over the years. I mean, if I could like sum it up in just a phrase of what he said, it's that you are West Virginia's premier singer-songwriter. And I think that's definitely something to hold close.
Yeah, well, that kind of blows my mind. Part of me thinks that's, you know, of course, I love that that he champions what I do. You know, it's been big. I don't know what to say about being the premier. There are so many great songwriters in West Virginia, you know.
There are. And actually, I will say that, so you mentioned Billy/William Matheny earlier in the chat. And he's another singer-songwriter, rocker out of Morgantown. And he appears on this Todd Burge Live on Mountain Stage CD. How did you get to know Billy, or how did he end up on in the performance?
Well, I had a little – I used to do a podcast. It was a radio show at first on United 2 in Morgantown called Songwriter Night. And I did that for a few years. I should also tell you that I want to mention that this is a little trivia for you, Mountain Stage trivia. That did you know I was the only Mountain Stage co-host in the history of Mountain Stage?
You were a co-host of Mountain Stage?
Yes.
When was that?
That was in 2011. I co-hosted for like 35 seconds. And
wait, 35 seconds? What did you do in the 35 seconds?
Well, we'll get back to that.
But first, teaser, that's
this,
great.
Well, this leads into it. So I did this show called Songwriter Night. It was like an hour-long thing, and I'd go to Morgantown, and we would have songwriters come. Like it was an invitational. It wasn't like an open mic, and we'd record them, and it was just songs. It wasn't like I interviewed anybody or anything. I'd edit it later, and later it was like a podcast, and it was on a few stations, and I had Larry Gross on. William Matheny, who was Billy at the time, came on that show when I was in Morgantown, and he came with his dad. He was, I think he was 15. I know that he wasn't older, and he played like two songs. Well, both of them were amazing, and one of them just blew me away because I just thought it was so mature, you know, and it reminded me of some Springsteen thing. It was so deep and dark, and I was talking to his dad. I was like, holy cow, when did he write that? And he said, oh, he wrote that like a year and a half ago. Well, it's just, he was like 13 and a half when he wrote this song. It was blowing me away. I mean, the guy was, he's been amazing for years, you know, and then I saw him, fast forward a couple of years later, I saw him backing up some other songwriter, and he was playing two or three different instruments. And I was doing solo stuff, and I thought, God, I need that dude to play with me, you know? And so that's where it all started, where we were doing duo shows for a while. I don't know, back in 2004 or 5 or whatever. And then I bring him on Mountain Stage and add him to the band here and there. I mean, the guy's amazing. Everybody knows that. It's seen him. You know, I saw him in a, you know, drumming for the Weed Hawks, and plays everything. So
he reminds me of like a mini version of you in a way. I mean, you guys have that kind of wry, sardonic sense of humor, and then also just the witty songwriting, and I think you guys are kind of a pair of sorts.
Well, you see, he's inspired me. He influences me. He's I hear that too. But he's been, like I said, you know, I've been around him, and he's definitely inspired some ideas. You know, I could go through two or three of these songs where I kind of rip him off, you know? and chord structures and stuff. Hip About Time, the first song in there, was something I saw him do the way that it goes into the chorus of that song. It was just something I saw him do, and I took it and inserted it in two or three of my songs. But anyway, the Mountain Stage co-host thing. So Larry was on this show, Songwriter Night, that I was telling you about, that he did it in Parkersburg. He listened to it on line, you know, and he thought, you know, you do a good job of this. Maybe you take my job in a few years when I retire. It was just like a joke, you know. But he literally, you know, he asked me to come on and co-host a show, and he was trying to figure out how to have me co-host a show. And just kind of dabbling with this idea, I don't know, it never formalized into anything. And I introduced Southeast Engine, band that Billy Matheny was in Athens, kind of, you know, little brief co-host stint. I think it's the only time it's ever happened. I mean, has it ever happened that you know of? I don't know.
I mean, the only one I know of is the actual host with Tim O'Brien, which is about two-ish years back. But as a co-host, I don't know if it's happened before. Yet again, this is the first time that maybe someone's told me, but this is kind of the first time someone's told me that there's a co-host, even for, what, 35 seconds, 46 seconds, what you said?
It was one band, and man, I had people emailing me, and people were like, what the hell was that? You know, people texting me, like, what just happened? You know, like, it was Hot Tuna, and I think the Jayhawks were on that show, maybe. And I just did one song, and actually it's on this CD. I did Joseph's Prayer to His Baby Son, and then I stayed up there and introduced Southeast Engine.
That's crazy. And no one knew in the audience that you were going to do that.
Huh?
No one in the audience knew that you were going to introduce the next the next act.
And Larry didn't tell anybody, the crew. And so it was like, and they were setting up a mic for me to host on the other side, away from my vote. You know, it was like, you do it over here. And anyway, I'm making too much of it, but I always thought that on my bio, I should write Mountain Stage co-host October 12th, 2011, and put the time in there.
The timestamp of the 36 seconds that you were hosting the show.
On my bio.
Mountain Stage is full of surprises, so I'm not surprised that they kind of kept it a secret to everyone involved, even the people involved in the actual show.
Well, let me say this. I guess I didn't pass the audition. You know,
it's a tough. I've heard that being a host is a tough gig. I wish the best of luck to anyone who's going to do it, because Larry is a master of his craft, and being up on stage and talking naturally but still having enough information to make it seem like he knows everything when really it's on a script. It takes the 32 years to really be that comfortable, and he has it under his belt.
Yeah, I mean, that was that's an art. There's no doubt about it. I mean, the whole thing, I was kind of surprised when I'm traveling, actually in West Virginia, I'll sometimes in Charleston, people say they've never seen a Mountain Stage.
I know, right? It's crazy.
They've never experienced it. They've never watched that, because it's a well-oiled machine that you guys put on there, and it's amazing. And you know, so let's praise Larry Gross for a few more seconds. He deserves, you know.
No, he does. Especially with West Virginia. I mean, like, him being able to keep this up and running, and the entire crew, him and the whole team, keeping this up and running in the same shape, but still evolving the sound to keep up with taste over the last three decades.
Yeah.
That's a lot of luck, but that's also a lot of work, and they've made it happen.
Well, you know, I think that hard work creates luck, and but the focus and the ability to create that team and sustain it, to just create the team that what Andy and you know Larry did from the get go, and yeah, and like you said, the ability to sustain it and to accept change and all that, you know, it's geez, I marvel over it and inspired by it.
Yeah. Well, I do want to ask. So you have this new record, you know, based around Mountain Stage, but it is a live. It's a set of live recordings. What's the difference, and what's the value in having these live recordings versus, you know, say a studio recording?
Yeah, it's value. It's funny because I've played like maybe four shows since it came out. It's all new, really. Most of the shows will kick up late summer and fall, where it's. But early on, there's a difference because I've never really had a live solo CD like this. And people, even though some of my recordings, I'm really proud of a few of my recordings. Even one, I sat in a circle at Tim O'Brien's house and we recorded it live. But it doesn't sound like I sound solo, you know. I always say that the CD is small, but it's the music's been enlarged to show texture, you know, and that's what happens in the studio. You basically you take the songs and you expand them, and they're it's nothing like what the live experience is like. But people are always asking me when I play live, what CD is most like what you just did. And I've never had. I'm like, well, nothing really. I don't say that out loud, but and this really isn't either because I've got the Mountain Stage Band on most of these songs. But there are solo songs on here, and it is real and it is live, and it's just a totally different vibe. There's, you know, Jesus Nightlife, for example, is, you know, I listened to it back and it rocks, you know, whereas. My CDs in most recent years, nobody would say that they're like rock and roll, you know. Some of these songs, a couple of them rock. There's an energy to them that you just can't get in a studio, you know. So there's a huge difference, really. It's just a totally different beast.
Now, we've talked a bit about, you know, you being a singer-songwriter in West Virginia. I think if there's just like a little ticker count, it would probably just be up there in like the tens. But what does it take to be and continue to make music in the state? Like, what advice would you give to others if they're looking into pursuing this kind of career?
You know, the West Virginia thing is brought up as almost like it's a weight that we're carrying, or we're trapped on this side of the mountain range, or we're living in a bubble or whatever, you know. And I think people make a lot of that. But I say, if I were going to say anything, is get in your car and drive out of the state and play some shows and then come back. You know, it's that simple. But mainly, you know, it's being from West Virginia is a big plus. And I know this guy. I've lived in Austin, Texas. I've lived in San Francisco. I've lived in Pittsburgh, and I've lived most of my life in West Virginia. And believe me, what I would tell people is work your ass off, because most people do not organize your work. Get in your car, you know, book the shows and go, you know, but the main thing is make your show as good as it can be. And then once you get it as good as it can be, make your show better and keep doing that and make that the priority. But really where you are, where you live and all that, I'm here because I want to be, you know, and I, maybe I have to be in West Virginia. This is where I've got to be, but if I was working a job, whatever a regular job means, you know, maybe if I had a bagel stand on Market Street in Parkersburg,
yum,
and had to tend to that every day and had to stay here and left twice a year to go on a vacation, I don't know that I could do that, you know? Yeah, I think it's a plus. When I, especially I go up north, and people are enamored by the fact that I'm from West Virginia. I got a little bit of twang in my voice, and they dig that. And I find that going, you know, playing Florida and places like that too. There's some sort of thing. There's this thing about West Virginia, and the whole bit of the stereotypes that everybody embraces, and the I grew up, I didn't see a coal mine until I went to school in Morgantown. Like, people would think coal mines, and a lot of people didn't even know that we were a state and all that crap.
Yeah.
You know, we can talk about it. Everybody knows that. But the fact is, it's a great place to tour out of. Parkersburg is a great, you know, if you draw a 5-6 hour circle around where I live, it's a beautiful place to be for routing. And I didn't find that in Austin. You know, Lyle Lovett and Willie Nelson are the only two people making money. You know, everybody's playing for tips. You know, bigger markets. Go to the bigger markets. Go to the conferences. Go to the, you know, do all that stuff as much as you can. And geez, this is a beautiful place to be. It's great.
That was Todd Burge. His newest release is Todd Burge Live on Mountain Stage. You can find him, his music, and his tour schedule on toddburge.com. You can hear his music on A Change of Tune, airing Saturday nights at 10 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And for more hashtag WV Music Chats, make sure to go to wvpublic.org/WVMusic. I'm Joni Deutsch. Thanks for listening.